Oh, thank you for the invitation. I'm really happy to be here. So scalar gauge theories and dark matter. This is some work we did with many people in Pisa. If you have a look at the papers, you understand why there are so many people in the work, like 50 pages each with many, many, many calculations in different models. And let me say that Giacomo Landini and Jingwei Wang are the two PhD students who did a very tough job. So they did most of the calculations in this paper. So I think they deserve some special acknowledgement. Here in the box is basically the content of my talk. So I consider this very simple scenario. Young Mills theory, new gauge group G with some gauge coupling, plus one scalar field, which is in some representation of this new gauge group. Can be real or complex, whatever. And then we'll study the possibility that these very simple theories describe dark matter, a dark sector. Since this is completely decoupled from the standard model, the only way I will allow them to speak with the standard model is through the Higgs portal. So this is really an outline of what I will do. And I will do it for many different gauge groups. So you may ask, why? Why do I want to do that? Well, why not, first of all? It's a very simple model, simple and predictive. It's actually almost as minimal as the most minimal dark matter model that we have, which is minimal dark matter indeed. And the only difference is that here, now I charge the dark matter under a new gauge group instead of the usual standard model one. Now, this is crucial because one has to face the fact that at least the standard WIMP paradigm, that is a simple WIMP paradigm, is getting more and more challenged. I don't want to say excluded because it's not true, but challenged by experiments, direct and indirect constraints. And this is due to the fact that thermal phase out of dark matter in the early universe is controlled by the same coupling that also controls interaction with the standard model. So if you want to reduce the cross-section of dark matter detection today, you clearly need to disentangle these two processes somehow. And this is exactly what I do here. So on one hand, the coupling of the standard to the standard model here is controlled only by the Higgs portal coupling, which is different from the gauge coupling, which controls dark matter production. And this portal coupling can be made small at will. At the same time, since the gauge coupling is new, it's not a standard model coupling, its size is completely free. And this allows me to thermally produce dark matter by thermal phase out, changing the mass, not being fixed to the TV scale like the usual WIMP. And in particular, I will be interested in the case where the dark matter is heavy, and this means the gauge coupling is larger than the standard model, the weak couplings. And this is because if you go to heavy dark matter, the experimental bounds are quickly vanishing. You get out of the window where you have direct and indirect detection. The upper bound, of course, is when this G becomes completely non-perturbative, and then you can go up to masses of order a few hundreds of TV. From a completely different point of view, this scenario corresponds to the case where dark matter is composite, actually, if you have a strongly coupled gauge group. And so that's the idea that dark matter is a bound state of some new dark force that confines at some scale, which can be, this is well known, from a few GeV up to the hundreds of TV that I just said. And this is a well-known topic, has been studied a lot in the literature by many, many different people. Usually, all these works have been considering only QCD-like theories, namely theories where you have some fermionic constituents, which is bound, and then the dark matter can be baryon, mesons, or whatever. Here, I will do it with scalars. So the constituents of my strongly coupled dark matter will be scalars. The key difference with respect to the usual QCD models is that scalars can have a potential, unlike fermions. So this is a new effect that can have an interplay with the confinement, and it can break the gauge group in particular. So what we did is to make a kind of complete study of this type of theories for simplest representations of all the possible Lie groups. So we consider SUN, SON, SPN, even exceptional groups. It's some point we were getting excited doing calculation, we couldn't stop. Of course, today I cannot discuss everything because otherwise I kill you. I will mostly discuss the simple SUN models. And then if I have time, I will maybe sketch some particular cases from more general models. Okay. Let me start from the very, very, very basic examples. Let me skip the most trivial one, which is a real singlet, because we all know that. Let me consider the simplest case where you actually have a gauge group, which is scalar QD. So you have a complex scalar field phi, which has a U1 gauge symmetry. Now, this scalar is going to be stable automatically because of charge conservation. So it can be a dark matter candidate. If the gauge group is broken, however, of course, there is no charge conservation anymore, but if you impose that there is no kinetic mixing between the new U1 and hypercharge, then charge conjugation is still a symmetry, as you can easily check. And in that case, then the massive U1 gauge boson will be stable because of charge conjugation, will be charged, of course, and can be a dark matter candidate. But you see, you need to impose this condition. So basically, you're imposing the stability of dark matter by hand. It's not inside the theory. To get a better model, a more, if you want, naturally stable dark matter model, you need to go to non-abelian gauge groups. So the next simplest model is also very simple. You all know it. It's basically the Higgs. Take SU2 and a scalar field, which is a doublet of this SU2. This has been considered in the context of dark matter for the first time by Tomambi. And I mean, the phenomenology is trivial. You all know Higgs can get a VEV. This breaks SU2 to nothing. The spectrum is the one that you know, three heavy vector bosons and the Higgs excitation. Now, the crucial thing is that in this case, the Lagrangian has a custodial symmetry, which is SO4. So four that transforms the four that rotates the four components of the Higgs field, which is broken to SO3 by the VEV. And the consequence of this symmetry is that on one hand, the Ws are stable because they are triplets of this SO3 custodial symmetry. And this is completely accidental. So this is a symmetry of the theory without imposing anything by hand. It's like Baryon number in the standard model. It comes for free in the theory. And also the three vectors have a common mass because they transform as a triplet of this symmetry. Okay, so far so good. And then here you can work out the phenomenology. This is well known, I will not repeat it. You can calculate abundance of these Ws and so on. Then you might ask, what happens in the...
In this other limit.
Well, the gauge group is not broken, so there is no VEV for the scalar phi. In this case, SU2 is asymptotically free, so at low energies it will confine at some scale where the gauge coupling becomes large. And this is apparently a completely different model because the asymptotic states are singlets of the gauge group. They will be composite. You can write them down. You have mesons made from a scalar phi and an anti-scalar, phi star. Can be scalar, spin one, et cetera. You have also baryons, because in SU2 you can bind two doublets together with an epsilon tensor and make a singlet. These have to be spin one because otherwise they vanish due to antisymmetry. You have only one scalar, so. And then you have other states. You have excited resonances, globals, and so on that are more massive. You still have the custodial symmetry because it's a symmetry of the Lagrangian. However, this SO4, which is two copies of SO3, one of the SO3s is the gauge symmetry, and all the states are singlets under this. So this is a trivial symmetry for the asymptotic states. So the symmetry which is relevant to classify the global symmetry which classifies the asymptotic states is again SO3 as before. The confinement doesn't break this symmetry because the condensate is invariant under all these symmetries. And you can classify your states under this SO3 you see that the scalar meson is a singlet. And the vector meson, together with the two vector baryons that we had, form a triplet of this SU3. And now we realize that these are exactly the same quantum numbers under the custodial SU3 as our elementary Higgs and W bosons that we had before. So the physics of this model is exactly the same as the one of the perturbative model of the usual Higgs sector. And this is an aspect of something deeper, which is known as the equivalence of the Higgs and confined phase, which has been proven non-perturbatively for this model. So whether the Higgs breaks the gauge group completely with a VEV, or it doesn't and the group confines, gives you exactly the same physics. The interactions, of course, are different. Of course, you can have order one numbers which will be different, but there is no phase transition, which means that the basic properties of the theory are exactly the same. And the way the physical observables depend on the parameters of the Lagrangian is continuous and actually analytic. And this can be made more formal. I mean, there is actually a theorem, very famous, which states the following, that if you are in a case where there is a scalar field which takes a VEV, and this breaks completely the gauge group to nothing, like was the case before for SU2, then you can prove these things. The global symmetries of the Higgs phase and of the confined phase are the same, the asymptotic states are the same, and they transform in the same way under these symmetries, and all the amplitudes are analytic functions of the parameters. In other words, there is no phase transition when the confinement scale becomes bigger than the symmetry breaking scale. This is proven non-perturbatively on the lattice, and it's completely true in quantum field theory. The way I understand it, well, there is another theorem due to these people, also very famous result in QFT, is that for actually any QFT, there is always an equivalent formulation in terms of composite fields. And when the gauge group is completely broken, so in the hypothesis of this theorem, then all these composite fields are gauge invariant under the group G. And so you see, somehow this means that you are really in a composite phase, I mean, in a confined phase where you have composite states that are singlets. The situation is slightly more complicated if the gauge group is not completely broken. Because if there is a residual gauge group H, then there is additional gauge dynamics below the symmetry breaking scale.
Can I ask, do you end up having any light massless cold stones?
Depends on the model.
Okay.
So
how likely is it? I guess in the case you were discussing, there is no such
thing. Here there is no such thing because all the goldstones are eaten by the gauge vectors.
Yeah, so you cannot, right, because of your theorem.
Why?
Because then you will have like an amplitude mediated by something that is massless, which in the perturbative case you don't have. There's nothing massless.
Exactly. Indeed, you're right. I never have massless or light states in all the cases where this theorem applies. I will show you some example where I have massless states, or for instance, dark photons. But all these cases are cases where the theorem doesn't apply. I will show them at the end, if I have time.
There is a remnant subgroup, which is unbroken.
Yeah, but as I'm going to say, so it looks like the complementarity principle, namely this equivalence of phases, is valid more in general, not only in the cases where the group is completely broken. And this has been already suggested many years ago by Savas and collaborators. And what people think to know is that this works always when scalars are in the fundamental representation of the gauge group, even if, of course, not always the gauge group is completely broken. And what is crucial to make this work is that you need to take into account the confinement of the Renmann group in these cases. Otherwise, it doesn't work. So you need to check the correspondence between composite states of the full G confinement and composite states made of, you know, constituents that are confined by the Renmann group H. Now, we think we have kind of shown that this correspondence works whenever there is a unique breaking pattern G to H. So when your Higgs field can break the group G in only one possible way, and you have no choice, and this is actually a case for fundamental representations of SUN, SON, SPN, and G2, which is an exceptional group. And this is the only case where this is true. In this case, the two phases coincide. So the reason is not really the fundamental representation. There are fundamental representations of other exceptional groups where this is not true, and you can show that the correspondence doesn't work. So it's related to the fact that you have a unique way to break the group.
That means that, like, wherever, like, if you have a potential with several minima, like, in all minima, the pattern of breaking is the same. That's what.
Exactly. If you have different minima, which have different physics,
different
which,
pattern of breaking,
then of course, you have different physics already in the Higgs phase. So at least you have to choose one phase to coincide with the confined phase. But more in general, it never coincides. But if you have one single way of breaking, then this will coincide with the confined picture. Okay. And of course, we don't have a completely formal proof of this in a non-perturbative way. We just checked that the states match. If you calculate the states in a perturbative way in the Higgs picture, and if you compute the composite states that you have, they are the same. And
is that all your models only have like one Higgs? Never have like multiple Higgs?
In this case, yes.
Right. If you had multiple Higgs, then you will have different values.
Yeah. I'll show you. So let me consider SUN. I will spend most of the time with this SUN model because it's easy, and then things will easily generalize. So take one scalar and a fundamental. This is an N2 and n-dimensional vector. It always breaks SUN to SUN minus 1, of course, because it can always align the VEV to one direction. The theory has an accidental global symmetry, which is baryon number. It's the conserved charge that transforms this scalar field phi. And a VEV of phi, of course, breaks this baryon number because it's charge. But you can show that you always have a global U1 which is unbroken. And the unbroken U1 will be a combination of baryon number and one of the generators of the gauge group. So there will be some combination of these two things which will always be unbroken. You can easily compute a spectrum. It's almost standard model-like, really. You have the Higgs, which is the fluctuation around the VEV, which is a singlet. You have the massless, let's call them gluons, which are the gauge bosons of the remnant SUN minus 1, which will confine at some point at low scales. You have the heavy Ws, which are the broken generators, and they are in a fundamental and anti-fundamental of SUN minus 1, of course. And they are charged under the unbroken U1 that I was discussing before. So they are stable because they are the only charged states under this U1 that you have in the theory. And these guys are going to be my dark matter candidate. And then you also have a massive singlet, which is basically the Z boson. Now, before, in the simple SU2 model, the Z was stable because of the custodial symmetry. It's known that for any SUN bigger than 2, there is no custodial symmetry. So in that case, the Z is going to be, since it's not charged under the baryon number, it's going to decay. And it decays to globals, basically.
So there is a U1, there is a photon here.
No, where?
So the U1 is unbroken. So it's a global symmetry?
Global. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's global because the U1 is a combination of baryon number, which is a global symmetry.
Sorry.
And a broken generator. This is the n square minus 1 generator, that's the Z.
I see.
But the global part of the generator, No, there is no photon here. It's like the standard model without hypercharge. Okay, this is not the whole story. Now, at low energies, this SUN minus 1 will confine at this scale here. And the bound states that you form are these. Of course, the Higgs and the Z are singlets, so they don't speak. They don't care about the confinement. The gluons will confine into globals, which are heavy. And the Ws, the heavy Ws, can either form mesons, when you put together a W and a W dagger. And these have baryon number 0, because this is minus 1, this is plus 1, so they decay, and they decay to W star annihilations. On the other hand, you have also dark baryons, which is when you put together n minus 1 w's with an epsilon tensor in an antisymmetric way. And these are, of course, charged under the baryon number, like the w. And so they are going to be our stable dark matter candidates. There is at least one limit when the W mass is heavy compared to the confinement scale, where you can easily even compute the spectrum of these baryons, because everything is non-relativistic, so you can really use quantum mechanics. And actually, the lightest state will most likely be the one where the angular, the spatial angular momentum is minimal, so you need to impose that the wave function is antisymmetric. And these are a few examples. I mean, for instance, consider a case where you bind two W's together to form a baryon. Well, this is when SU3 is broken to SU2. And you have to form an antisymmetric wave function out of two vectors. And this gives, again, a vector, because the antisymmetric combination of two spin 1 is a spin 1. So the lightest baryon is going to be spin 1. If you put three W's together, antisymmetric combination of three vectors is a scalar. And in this case, you will have a scalar baryon, which is the lightest, and so on. You can continue. Okay, now let's go to the other case, where I don't break the gauge group. So my theory is really the theory of an SUN, which confines, and one scalar field without a web. Here again, I directly construct the bound states. Again, I have globals, which this time will be globals of the full, of all the gauge fields together. You have a spin zero meson. You have a spin one meson, as before. And you have dark baryons again. You can put together n scalar fields with an epsilon tensor. Of course, you need to put derivatives here, otherwise it's going to be zero. But again, this is stable due to dark baryon number. Now the original baryon number, the really phi number. If you write down explicitly these baryonic states, you can explicitly check that they exactly match the baryons that I had before, that I had here. Let me try to convince you of this fact. It's easy. You put n scalar fields together with an epsilon tensor. N minus 1 of them need to have derivatives. Otherwise, as soon as you have two fields without derivative, it's going to be zero by antisymmetry. And now we can always align the VEV in the other picture of this field to be along this direction here, this alpha 1. Now, due to the epsilon, all the other indices here, alpha 2, alpha n, are not the one of the VEV, are orthogonal. So these are all Goldstones. And now, d mu of the Goldstone is exactly the W, coincides with the W. So this is, if you replace this phi with a VEV, it's an n minus 1 epsilon with n minus 1 W's, which is exactly the baryon that I had before. So all the states of this composite picture match the states of the Higgs picture. And this is almost a proof, I would say, of the fact that the two theories coincide. This was, by the way, already known before. I mean, these SUN models with the fundamental scalar are kind of known to have this property. But we find the same thing for all the other models that we considered, where you have a unique breaking. I was cheating a bit. There is one thing you have to pay attention to, and namely, I never showed you that the Stern dynamics actually doesn't break baryon number. In other words, it could be that the baryon operator gets a condensate in principle because it's a singlet. Now, in all theories that we know, this doesn't happen. For instance, in QCD, you could also generate a condensate for the baryons. This would even violate Lorentz symmetry because baryon is a fermion in that case. And it doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen not because you have to preserve Lorentz symmetry. That's a consequence. It doesn't happen for some dynamical reason of QCD. Now, in QCD and in any vector-like fermionic gauge theory, this happens because of Waffa-Witten theorem. Waffa-Witten theorem tells you that the condensate never breaks the vector-like symmetry, and baryon number is a vector-like symmetry. Now, in this case, it's a bit more tricky because the theory doesn't really hold for general scalar theories with a potential. Because when the effect of scalar self-interaction is big, then the proof of the theorem doesn't work. And the self-coupling of the scalars is actually big in the infrared when the group confines due to RGE. So it's not really clear what happens for these scalar gauge theories when they confine. For simplicity, I will just assume that this condensate don't form. Phi Dagger Phi is the only condensate that you have, the standard one, and my confinement doesn't affect baryon number. Of course, it would be great to have some more robust result on that, but it doesn't seem to be easy. Okay, questions until now? If not, I move to phenomenology. Now, I have the model. This is the most general potential at a renormalizable level. You have the potential for phi, the potential for the Higgs, and the portal coupling. I have four parameters beyond the standard model. For the sake of simplicity, I will consider a special case, namely the case when this potential is completely scale invariant. That is, I set the two mass parameters to zero, exactly. In this case, I generate all the scales dynamically with a kind of Coleman-Weinberg potential. So the W scale, which is the VEV of phi, is generated when the quartic coupling of phi gets negative in the infrared. And since there is a portal coupling, this also triggers a non-zero electroweak scale, which will be proportional to this W times the portal coupling. Now I have two parameters less. I can fix one more parameter if I impose that the dark matter has the observed abundance. I can calculate the abundance assuming thermal freeze out in the early universe. And then I remain with only one free parameter, which is basically the gauge coupling. Now notice, the fact that I don't have a phase transition between the two regimes, between the Higgs and confinement regime, means that I can do the computations for whatever coupling I want, in particular in the perturbative case, and then extrapolate what I find to the strongly coupled case. And I know that I will have order one factors, but the physics will not dramatically change, okay? Now, I need to calculate the relic abundance. As I will show you, this is non-trivial. It's quite a complex thing. So you start at high temperatures in the early universe, where you have a bath of gauge vectors and scalars in thermal equilibrium. And at the end, late times, you want to end up with dark baryons and nothing else, because dark baryon is the only stable object that you have. The first thing that happens is the usual freeze out of elementary W annihilations. So, as usual, when the rate of these annihilations drops below the Hubble rate, they cannot annihilate anymore. Since the W is heavy, this is well known, like for the WIMP, it happens at temperatures of order MW, over 25. This is for a cold relic. And then the relic abundance is calculated in terms of the annihilation cross section. The annihilation cross section is, in the perturbative case, you can compute. There will be some factor which depends on the gauge group, easy to calculate, and then it depends, it goes like g to the fourth over mw squared. You have different channels, but you can calculate all these cross sections. In the non-perturbative case, they will all go to roughly some number times 1 over lambda squared. So, okay, and through this you can calculate the abundance of W and anti-W that you have after this fizzes out. The next thing that happens, the temperature drops even more, and at some point you reach the confinement scale, and these W's and anti-W's will confine into baryons and mesons. But now, the mesons are unstable, and the baryons are stable. This means that for some phase, after the W's have frozen out, they cannot find each other anymore, and they don't annihilate. But when you confine, they automatically get close again to each other inside the bound states. And if there are a W and an anti-W in the bound state, they will again find each other to annihilate. So here you need to compute how many of the elementary W's will find themselves into invariants, which are stable, and how many will become mesons, which decay. You can estimate this fraction in the following way. If you assume nearest neighbor interaction, then you see that the probability to bind a W with another object into a meson is 1/2. Because if this other object is a W star, then you form a meson. If it's a W, you don't form a meson. On the other hand, the probability to bind constituents in a baryon is 1/2 elevated to the number of states that you have in the baryon, -1. Because you need to find a W and not an anti-W n to the n -1 times. Okay, so at the end, but in addition, there is also a factor coming from the fact that the baryon contains more particles than a meson. So in the end, you get a formula like this. So this is another one coefficient for small n's. For large n, it goes quickly to 0, so it's easier to form mesons and baryons. And this is something we take into account. After that, you are left with only baryons, which are our dark matter candidates. But the story is not over, because they have baryons and antibaryons. And now again, they can annihilate with each other. And the cross-section is completely different from the one for elementary W annihilation, so it's not frozen out yet. And here, this cross-section has a small, actually, contribution from the perturbative WW bar annihilation, but the dominant effect comes from recombination-like effects, which gives a geometric cross-section. Basically, whenever the wave function of the two composite states overlap, then it's not that the elementary partons inside scatter with each other, but they can rearrange, forming from a baryon and an antibaryon, forming many mesons, and then the mesons will eventually decay. So the cross-section is completely independent from the elementary cross-section of the constituents. And it's basically pi times the size of the baryon square. Actually, this cross-section becomes large when the gauge coupling is very small, because then the Bohr radius becomes big. There are also thermal corrections to this. If this reaction decouples at a temperature which is higher than the binding energy, then the annihilation is not between ground state baryons, but between excited states, which are bigger. And in this case, you can compute that the cross-section will go like 1 over lambda square, where lambda is really the confinement scale of the baryons. So we take into account all these effects. The main message here is that the decoupling of baryons happens at a much lower temperature than the mass of the elementary constituents. And this means that you can suppress easily the dark matter abundance with respect to the usual thermal phase-out of WIMPs. So you can have heavy dark matter, which doesn't overclose the universe. We are almost done, so this gives you a prediction of the number of baryons that we have at the end of the phase-out of this process. There is one thing that can happen after, namely...
The confinement scale should be still relatively close to the weak scale, right? I mean, NW can be much higher, but still what sets eventually the cross-section, the annihilation cross-section is rather lambda, and so that should be quite close to the...
So, the annihilation cross-section... No, first of all, lambda doesn't have to be close to MW. They can be exponentially separated.
Sure, yeah.
Second, this 1 over lambda square is only in the case where you have annihilation of excited states, which you don't know. I mean, this depends on the strongly coupled dynamics. Otherwise, the annihilation cross-section is this one. There is some numerical factor, and then 1 over alpha MW squared.
Okay.
So, no, the scales, it can be parametrically different.
Okay.
And this is the main point. Now, of course, if you are not in the perturbative regime, but everything happens at the same scale because you confine everything together, then the mass of the baryon is going to be lambda, and the cross-section is 1 over lambda square, and there, I agree with you. There, you are simply in the usual case. Just last thing, if the standard model is reheated at late times after the baryons have frozen out, then the dark matter abundance can be diluted, simply because you inject energy and entropy into the standard model thermal bath after you have computed the abundance. And this actually happens because most of the Ws and anti-Ws annihilate to dark globules. And then the dark globules decay through the Higgs portal coupling, but the portal coupling can be small. So if the portal coupling is small, the lifetime of the dark globules is long. And so they will decay into standard model way after the baryon antibaryon have frozen out. Yeah, actually, if we are in the scale invariant case I was discussing, then when the scale W is much higher than the electroweak scale, actually, this is really the case. This lambda, the portal coupling has to be small. Yeah, so dark matter density gets diluted in this case.
But it's just a factor of G star, isn't it? It's just a change in G star or something like.
Sorry, say it again.
I mean, what's the how much do you dilute the dark matter density?
You dilute it. It depends how many of the Ws annihilate into dark globules. And this again depends on the portal coupling, because they can annihilate directly into standard model through the portal, or only into globules, and then the globules remain stable. So this you can compute. I mean, it depends. It's a bit involved, but need to compute how many go into globules and then how long the globules live. So it depends also on the temperature of the standard model bath when you, I mean, on the degrees of freedom, if you want, of the standard model.
The whole evolution of the temperature of the dark sector, like during this whole process of like, and condensation, annihilation, et cetera, is it going up, going down? So at very high temperatures, the temperature of this dark sector and the standard model were the same.
Yeah,
and all these funky things were happening in the dark sector. What happens with the temperature of the dark sector?
So since this portal coupling is kind of small, at some point, I mean, the two baths will be decoupled.
Yes.
So.
But you have all these funky things going within the dark sector.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So what's happening with the temperature of the dark sector?
Well, of course, it goes down, and then whenever there is a phase transition, I mean, as for the standard model, it's exactly the same. It's exactly the same. You have the confinement is like QCD phase transition, right?
Yeah.
Then you have this baryon annihilation. This is like recombination, broadly speaking. So it's really similar.
That's just factors of this.
Yeah.
Okay.
One thing, if this coupling is very small and the globules are very long lived, then of course you have bounds because the lifetime can become cosmological, and then you have bounds from BBN. So let me summarize. This is the final result, putting everything together. Vertical axis is the constituent W mass, which is the scale of symmetry breaking. Horizontal axis is the confinement scale, which is related to the gauge coupling. Red means you have too much dark matter. Green means you have too little dark matter. And so if you want to thermally reproduce the cosmological abundance, you have to be on the boundary between these two regions. I put two lines because I don't know exactly how the baryons annihilate. So this line here corresponds to a Bohr-like recombination, I mean, where the size of baryons is a Bohr radius, so ground state baryons. And this line corresponds to the case where you have excited baryons that annihilate and you have this large cross-section 1 over lambda square. Of course, if you are below this diagonal, you are in the condensed phase because the condensation scale is bigger than the constituent mass. And here everything merges. So all the cross sections are of the order of 1 over lambda square. in the upper left corner, this is the case where the portal coupling is small. So here you are already excluded by BBN. And here, in this region here, the dilution due to the globules is important. Naturally, you can see this because these dotted lines are what you would get for the continuation of this line without the dilution of the globules, which is possible if there is some additional physics where the globule can decay fast. You see, if you want to sit on this close to this line where the dark matter is thermal, then you are, you see, around between 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 5 or even more GV for the dark matter mass. Okay, then you can repeat the exercise for different groups and the lines change a little bit, but the conclusion is the same. You can try to compute bounds, but of course, since the mass is very large, the bounds will be very weak. So you have direct detection, which again goes through the portal coupling, because the W's inside the baryons speak with the Higgs of the dark sector, which then mixes with the Higgs of the standard model, and this couples to nucleons. And this gives you direct detection experiment cross-sections. Indirect detection is, again, the usual baryon-antibaryon annihilation, which is enhanced by these recombination effects. I have already calculated it. So you get these bounds here. This is indirect detection. This is direct detection. However, assuming that the dark matter abundance is the one that is actually, that we know, the dark matter abundance. Of course, if you have less dark matter than what we actually have, all these bounds get reduced by a lot. Because if you have less dark matter, you have less signal. So these are, since these lines completely sit in the green region where you have less dark matter than what you should have, they are not actually bounds. They are. And the dashed lines here are the prospects in the midterm future, and they are not very good. You see, you can hope to maybe touch this in some point, this line where you reproduce the dark matter. But for the moment, there are not really significant bounds on these models. Okay. How much time do I have?
So let's say 15 minutes to get to 2.
Fantastic. Yeah. So I can even finish maybe. So if this is clear, so I think this is more or less the complete picture of this simple SUN model. Now you can play and change the group and change the model and see if you have different predictions. I will not discuss all of them. Let me just discuss a few relevant examples to give you the taste of what can happen. So next model I want to discuss is SON. SON is again a case where if you take a scalar in the fundamental, you break the group in a unique way to SON minus one. The difference with the previous case is that the group is real. SON is real. So you don't have U1 charges. There is no U1, no conserved baryon number here. So you cannot stabilize the dark matter with a conserved charge. However, the theory is accidentally invariant under the full ON group, including rotations with determinant minus one. And if you take the quotient with the gauge group, you define a parity, a Z2, which is basically reflections in SON, in ON, sorry. And you see, if you see how this parity acts on the constituent, you see that basically the only state which is odd is the W. And so again, and this reflection is not broken by the VEV of the scalar field, so the W is going to be stable. But you see, in this case, the W is stable not because of a baryon number, but because of a parity, if you want. So it's a different model. Another difference, now you construct baryons, which are the stable states. And you see that in these SON models, since the model is real, you can two fundamentals can combine into an adjoint. In SUN, this will be fundamental times anti-fundamental gives an adjoint. Here, two fundamentals give an adjoint, which means that the baryons, if you have a baryon with several Ws, two of the Ws in the baryon can become a gluon. So the lighter, if the W is heavy, the lightest baryons are not made out of n Ws or n minus one Ws, but the lowest possible number of Ws, which is either one or even zero, if the depending whether n is even or odd, and gluons. So in SON, the gluons can be valence constituents of baryons. You see, for n even, the lightest baryon will be one W and a bunch of gluons together. And for n odd, which means n minus one even, you just have a bunch of gluons, which are bound together in an antisymmetric way, and this state is stable. You can again check that the baryons in the confined phase exactly match the ones that I have in the broken phase. So again, the theorem holds. The two phases are equivalent. For the phenomenology, the fact that the lightest baryon always contains massless constituents means that the constituents are relativistic, so you never have this Bohr radius-like annihilation. It's always non-perturbative because the you never have like a heavy meson with two heavy constituents inside. You always have like a light meson, like a rho or a pi in QCD, and there the cross sections are 1/λ². Actually, for odd n, like in this SO5, the baryons don't even contain a single W. So the mass of the dark matter is completely independent from the breaking scale, because it's only made out of massless gluons. So all these lines are vertical, for instance, this indirect detection constraint. Okay, then, I mean, I can go on. SPN groups, I skip this because it's any model will have its own its own feature.
Then it's always the case that so always the dark matter candidate that you get, it must be heavy, and it's always really weakly coupled.
Yeah, always when you are in the because in the condensed phase, you have a strongly coupled composite state.
Yeah.
So it's heavy because it's like the thermal phase out of a state which couples with a strong coupling. It's strongly interacting mass, it's a simp.
Right.
And in the other phase, again, it might be weakly coupled, but the state is anyway a composite because it's, right?
Yeah.
So even if you have an elementary W, then there is a residual group which confines, and the dark matter is always a composite state.
Yeah.
So yes.
Yeah, but also your interactions within dark matter components, once it condensates and once everything freezes out, all those things, like with themselves, they are all weakly coupled. So of course the thing itself is it's condensed, it's a strong force, etc. But then you take two of these guys, you just like scatter them, they are weakly coupled, right?
Well,
because just the condensation scale is so large.
As an overall cross section, yeah. As an overall cross section, they're small, yes. But the overall cross section is small because they are heavy.
Right.
But compared to the mass of the guys, it's still a strongly coupled theory, like QCD.
Yeah, but
right. Yeah.
But sigma over m is always much smaller than.
Sigma over m is small. Yeah. And this is why you can have thermally such a heavy dark matter.
Yeah.
This is the reason.
Which makes it even it's even more depressing because the sigma is so small.
Yeah. Right. Okay, you see, here you could be able to directly detect some very, very small corner of this parameter space, but in general, there are no bounds on this on these models. Let me very quickly discuss G2, just because it's funny. I did barely know what G2 is before doing this exercise. So G2 is the group of octonion multiplication. Octonions are like quaternions, octonions. It's the only exceptional group where the fundamental breaks it in a unique way, and it breaks it to SU3. The group is almost a double copy of SU3, but real. It's some restriction of a double SU3 in a real combination. It has 7 generators. It has 14 generators. The fundamental has dimension 7. Which are the 7 imaginary elements of the octonion algebra. The spectrum is very similar to SU4 broken to SU3. SU4 has 1 generator more and 1 element more in the fundamental. It's almost the same as SU4 to SU3, just without a Z boson, because the group is real. You have no baryon number, because the group is real. You have a charge conjugation again, like in the SON case, which is accidental and is preserved by the VEV. And this becomes the usual C symmetry of SU3 after the group is broken. The difference between with this other case of SU4 to SU3 is also the fact that you have interactions of this type, which are cubic in the Ws. And this comes from the fact that there is an additional object, which is this rank tree tensor, which is the one that defines octonion multiplication. And this, of course, allows the baryons to decay in principle, because you see it's a triple coupling in the Ws. However, you can see that there is the imaginary part of the baryon, which is baryon minus antibaryon, which is even under this charge conjugation, so it decays. And the real part, which is W plus, baryon plus antibaryon, which is odd. So this can be stable. So here the dark matter is similar to the KK bar system. So you have two states, which are one the C or CP conjugate of each other, and one combination is like the K short, if you want, which has a short lifetime and decays, and the other combination is like the K long, but here the lifetime is infinite. It's like a K long with an infinite lifetime. And this is going to be the dark matter. So I don't want to insist on this, just to show you that you can have also exotic models, no? Depending on which gauge group you choose. So to summarize, these are all the cases where the perturbative model and the composite model are the same, because there is no phase transition. You have many different dark matter candidates which are stabilized in different ways due to accidental symmetries that, however, depend on the specific the specifics of each of the models. Since there is a single phase, it means two things. It means that you can always take the smooth limit when the coupling becomes big, so do all the perturbative computations and then extend it to the composite case. On the other hand, it also means that the composite picture doesn't change dramatically if you include the fact that you have a potential for the scalar. So the phenomenology is very similar to the QCD-like models, where you just have baryons and mesons, which depend on the gauge group. And the fact that you can break a gauge group has no real effect here. And yes, and this is a general feature, the heavy dark matter. Now, in the last 5 minutes, I want to show you what can happen if you go beyond these simple cases, namely, when you go to models where you have different possible breakings and the composite and the elementary phases are different.
Can I ask a nice question? So what if I forget about the instrument? What if I just add a scalar, give it a mass at 100 TeV, and say that it has a strong quartic, and it still couples to the Higgs quartic. So the quartic is positive, so it doesn't get a VEV. And phi is, I mean, it's an excellent dark matter candidate because it's stable. So then,
how does it fizz out? You cannot do it thermally, right?
Why? Oh, there is
because it free because the quartic doesn't contribute to fizz out. The fizz out will be given by the portal. So to thermally give the dark matter, you need a big portal.
Yeah.
And so this is the model that I skipped, right? So.
So you need the portal here. Why?
Okay, you need the portal because you wanted to speak with dark with standard model at some point.
Because of thermalization. Also.
And because you want thermal product. No, of course you.
But then if phi thermalizes, right? And it has some, it freezes out with the standard model at a certain temperature.
But what is the coupling to the standard model?
This portal.
This portal, yes.
So then it's going to be in thermal equilibrium.
Yes. But so for. No, but then in order to, the portal needs to be rather small because of direct detection bounds, and this means that it needs to be light. Of course, this model works when the scalar is light. Yes. But for heavy scalar, this model, this is like the WIMP, right? The coupling to standard model is related to the freeze out coupling.
But
so
here you want to have a small thermal range within that sector, a thermal abundance within that sector. So the temperature of that sector is set by the standard model temperature.
Well, in my case, yes, because at some point it was in thermal equilibrium and then the freeze out was given by a different coupling. But if the freeze out is given by this portal coupling, then how can you separate the
two? Yeah.
This is the usual, no, this is the simplest model, right? The singlet with the portal, which is not dead. It's absolutely not dead.
Yeah.
But it's dead if the scalar is heavy.
Okay.
Here the scalar must be light.
Unless lambda is large, here you're right. Yeah.
No, exactly, unless lambda is large, but lambda too large is constrained by, it starts to be constrained now by direct detection.
Here I'm saying, just to be absolutely correct, here I'm seeing the...
I'm sorry, have to.
Yeah, yeah. I'm almost done.
Yeah. When lambda is order of u, then the mass of the singlet scalar can be, if you just singlet scalar that matter, can be like 10 to the 4 GeV. 10 to the 3.
But lambda phi is it still allowed now?
Yeah.
By direct detection?
No, but this is just set two. Set two limit. So basically.
Yeah. Z2.
Yeah, that's what I'm just saying. It's a paper from 2019, so
I just... Sure, have a meeting, we have to run.
Sure.
Yeah, sorry, guys.
Let me quickly conclude, otherwise I run out of time. I want to show you quickly some different example. And, oops, I hope my battery survives.
It's fine, we have a cutoff for
it. Yeah. So in the second paper, we considered more general two-index representation of all these gauge groups. Here, in general, you can have two different quartic couplings, single trace and double trace. And this tells you that you can have different symmetry breaking patterns depending on the relative size of these couplings. An example is, for instance, SUN with phi in the symmetric, right? Now, it's well known that there are two configurations that minimize the scalar potential. And these two configurations are either the VEV is completely aligned in one direction, and this again breaks SUN to SUN minus 1. Or the scalar VEV is the identity, so all the entries are equal, and then you break SUN to SON. Okay, and depending on the parameters, on the two quartics, you can draw the phase diagram of this model. Now, let me consider a first case, just as an example, because it's similar to what I had before, with SUN broken to SUN minus 1. Again, you have the Higgs phase, which is, as before, with one difference. You have additional scalars, which are in the symmetric, which are not singlets under the gauge group, and are not Goldstones. So which are neither the Higgs nor the Goldstone which are eaten. And these additional scalars are crucial, because they are charged under the gauge group, and they enter confinement, and they will change the spectrum of asymptotic states that you have. So in this Higgs phase, if you confine SUN minus 1, you will have the usual baryons as before, which are an antisymmetric contraction of Ws. But you can also have dibaryons. I call them dibaryons because they have the charge of two baryons. So they have twice the charge of this B. And they are constructed with two epsilon tensors, one for each index of these symmetric scalars, right? Scalars are symmetric, have two indices. Each index you contract antisymmetrically with an epsilon. Since they have twice the charge of the baryon, they can decay into two baryons, if this is kinematically allowed. Now go to the confined phase. In the confined phase, you have to construct baryons out of the original scalar field, which is, again, in a symmetric. Again, you have these dibaryons. You can have two epsilon tensors, n-dimensional now, with n copies of this symmetric field, no problem. But now baryons exist only for even n, not for odd n. And this is due to the fact that phi has an even number of indices. So if phi has an even number of indices, you can contract it with an epsilon, because also epsilon has an even number of indices. But if the epsilon has an odd number of indices, like for n odd, you can never put together any number of these phis in order to have a singlet. So baryons with only one epsilon tensor exist only for even n. And so already from that, you see that the two phases cannot be the same, because the asymptotic states are different. There are states here that don't exist here. And in this case, you cannot do the simple game that I did before of computing something in the Higgs phase perturbatively and then extrapolating it to strong coupling and saying that, well, yeah, the physics is the same. You could have completely different physics. An even more dramatic example, I will not discuss it in detail, I just show you the result, is when you take an adjoint of SUN, If you take an adjoint of SUN in the confined phase, you don't even have a stable dark matter candidate. And this is due to the fact that with an adjoint you can have a triple coupling with a structural constant. And this makes dark matter decay. So in the confined phase, there is no dark matter. And in the perturbative Higgs phase, you have dark matter. And so here what happens, if you are in the perturbative phase, you increase the coupling, you increase the coupling, at some point you have the phase transition, and your dark matter disappears. It's a completely different theory. This is also an example, one of the examples where you have light states. Because with an adjoint, SUN is always broken to a sub, to something else and a U1 factor, because the direction in the adjoint where you break it will be a U1, which is preserved. So you have a dark photon here, which is massless. And so here you have bounds from dark radiation, from effective number of neutrinos, for instance. I mean, you can do the whole phenomenology, you can play. I don't have time to give you the details, but, one thing.
Yeah, actually the strongest bound is going to come from dark acoustic oscillations. The ineffective bound is usually much weaker than the dark acoustic oscillations.
Yeah, but, so I think what you refer to is this, is dark matter free streaming, right?
But the dark photon is here, it's not your dark matter, it's something else. It's the dark matter, dark photon, it remains as a mediator.
Dark photon is massless here.
Right, so what happens here is that you will have, like, your dark matter will have some mass, whatever, and then you will have this long-range interaction
exactly.
with the dark photon, and then the whole just dark matter fluid will oscillate.
Yeah,
it won't free stream, because it's tightly coupled to the dark photon.
Exactly. And this gives a bound of a few GV times G to the 4/3. And then there is another bound which comes from the fact that you can have that you have long range Coulomb scattering of dark matter due to the dark photon. And this gives bounds, for instance, from many different things, from the Ballet cluster, from ellipticity of halos, and so on. And this gives a much stronger bound, we found. And the bound is a few TV times G to the 4/3.
I will check dark. Well, I mean, it's just one of the models. But
so I think this is what we discussed yesterday, and I think we have it. I mean, we did the computation.
The dark acoustic oscillation one. I mean, none of those three ones is dark acoustic oscillations. Dark acoustic oscillations is another thing.
Isn't it the fact that dark matter doesn't free stream?
No, it's the fact that dark matter is tightly coupled through a long range interaction. So it's just like for the. It's the same thing that for baryons in the CMB, you find tightly coupled baryons.
So you spoil structure formation.
You just do this, and you see the wiggles.
Yes, I think.
In the power spectrum.
I think it's related to this one.
It's related, but it's not that bound. I can just show you the paper. It's
And is this bound stronger than a few TV?
I don't know if the same if the parametrics is the same. That's what I'm.
Okay, we can check.
We can just check it.
I don't want to discuss the details. I mean, the models are, there are many models.
Yeah,
if you are interested, you can check the paper. There is a kind of encyclopedic collection of all these possible models.
Yeah.
Just to show you that you can have more exotic things with respect to the ones that I discussed. Let me conclude, so almost on time. Scalar gauge trios can have a very rich phenomenology. Can have many different models with different properties. We perform an, I would say, almost complete study of SUN, SON, SPN, and exceptional group. So almost all the Lie groups with simple representations. The most, I think, striking thing is that almost always, and for reasons which are completely unrelated to each other and specific to each given model, you almost always have dark matter candidates, which come from some accidental symmetry of the theory. And the dark matter is heavy, and so the prospects for experimental searches are not so good. Okay, thanks.
Any more questions? If not, thanks for this heroic treatment of composition. And let's thank the speaker again. And we will have dinner tonight. If anybody's interested, please let us know.